is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine the 1941 book titled The Dual State, a contribution to the theory of dictatorship, written by German-Jewish socialist lawyer Ernst Frankel. Our guest is Purdue University Professor Emeritus Bill Mullen. He'll concentrate and focus on the dual state theory and what's known as the prerogative power as opposed to normative power, and take a look at the range of parallels that happened between Nazi Germany and what's going on in the USA today.
We next look directly at the record number of journalists who have been killed by Israeli forces while covering the war in Gaza.
Our guest, director and producer Robert Greenwald, documents this brutality of war and brings it to the screen in his new film, Gaza, Journalists Under Fire. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The German-Jewish lawyer Ernst Frankel escaped from fascist Germany and settled in the United States. In 1941, he wrote an extremely important book, which we're going to discuss today. The book is called The Dual State, A Contribution to Theory of Dictatorship. The book explains how Hitler availed himself of two systems of law. The first, Frankel called, the normative state. This is your traditional law that regulates things like contracts and property. It was practiced in Nazi Germany and kept things stable. The second, Frankel called, the prerogative state. These are the arbitrary, violent, and unlawful actions taken by Hitler and his gangs in the streets and the Nazis. These two systems of law existed side by side in Germany. And this is what we see developing now in the United States of America. We speak with returning guest, Purdue University's Professor Emeritus Bill Mullen, on the dual state theory and how it applies to America today. Bill Mullen last appeared on Law and Disorder to speak about the black anti-fascist tradition in our country. He's a contributor to the just-published Law and Disorder book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style. Bill Mullen, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. So glad to be here.
Bill, let's talk about fascism. What is fascism? It's not just a slur word, is it?
No, it's not. If it was just a slur word, the world would be a safer place. I like what Trotsky and Clara Zetkin said about fascism about 100 years ago, when they described it as a political response of capitalism to a crisis which attempts to restore profitability and order by attacking the working class, diminishing political opposition in all of its forms, reducing civil society, and using the levers of the state to enact power in and all ways in the name of preserving the ruling class power. And that's how I still see it.
Yeah, I remember Jim Cannon, one of the founders of the American Communist Party out of the IWW, said that fascism was peremptory counter-revolution.
Exactly. That's a great description.
Bill, who was Ernst Frankel? And why was his 1941 book, The Dual State, which analyzes fascist Germany in the 1930s, why was it considered a foundational text?
Frankel was a German-Jewish lawyer, actually fought in World War I, and during the Weimar years was active in defending mostly Jewish clients against criminal charges being brought by the German state. And in the meantime, he was working on a book which became The Dual State, which was his effort to analyze the way that the fascist regime was deploying the law to maintain and build power. And he actually wrote the book in a kind of underground fashion, didn't publish it till after he left Germany. And it has subsequently become, as you kind of say, a foundational text, both in legal studies, especially of authoritarian states, but also, you know, more broadly in German political science. He's considered a founding father of that. And I would argue, too, that he was somebody who really anticipated in the late 20th and early 21st century what we called critical legal theory or even critical race theory, because he was really trying to use a Marxist perspective to argue that the law is always in the service of the powerful and the ruling class and those who hold property. And those have become kind of commonly considered doctrines now because of the advance of legal theory. But I would put him at the front or the head of a line of thinkers who was leading us in that direction.
What's the concept? What was his concept of the dual state? Please talk about the normative state and the prerogative state as Frankl describes it.
Sure. So he understood the dual state as a state which had effectively two complementary spheres of law. The first was the normative state, was that sphere which was attempt to maintain and preserve the functions of capitalism, everything from trade to banking to the holding of private property. The prerogative state was the sphere of law where the state, and particularly for him, the Nazi Party, invented law to persecute enemies, what Carl Schmitt, the famous theorist, called internal enemies, in the name of repressing them, expelling them, or using them as scapegoats in the name of preserving fascist power. And what was powerful about this argument was that he was sort of attempting to show that this domain of law about internal enemies was meant to be complementary to and in service of the capitalist state. In other words, that scapegoating was a fundamental way in which power was maintained and racial coercion was used to help maintain that power. So it was a completely original analysis, and it also was powerful in the sense that it attempted to show that law was not natural under the fascist regime, that actually the counter-revolution of law was part of the counter-revolution of fascism.
Why do you think Frankl's concept of the dual state is a good analytical framework for understanding how the Nazis functioned in fascist Germany?
Well, it helps us understand, for example, a whole body of law that came out in 1935 called the Nuremberg Laws, which were really focusing on Jews in particular, but also communists, on queers, on people that the state considered to be dissidents, internal enemies, or undesirables. And that body of law, he called it prerogative law, because he was trying to name the mechanism of power by which the state identified and repressed internal subjects, internal citizens. What is powerful about it is it isolates that as a component of law, which allows us to separate in a way questions of subjectivity, racial identity, religiosity as particular targets of law, something that, again, we've kind of come to take for granted now, but he was one of the first ones to kind of name that process in Nazi Germany. And the second thing, to go back to something I said earlier, he wanted to show us that the functions of capitalism and the functions of racial exclusion, xenophobia, and anti-Semitism were not contradictory, but complementary. They actually reinforced each other. And I think, again, we've come to understand now, particularly in the times that we live in, that things like, you know, xenophobia and racism are actually deeply embedded in the workings of American law writ large, but are also becoming more and more fundamental to the way capital accumulation works and capitalism protects its own power.
So do you think that the dual state concept is a good tool for understanding what's going on in the USA today? Please talk about this in the separation of powers, the dissolution of the rule of law, of constitutional restraints, and the restraints on police power.
Yeah, that's a great question, Michael. Well, let's take the example of the executive order, right, which is actually a longstanding practice of the presidential wing. The executive order is a good example of prerogative law. It simply means that the president can declare, or the executive branch can declare a policy, a position, which can become enacted as law over the rest of us. So it's prerogative in a really literal sense. executive orders in the United States date all the way back, say, like Roosevelt creating the Japanese internment camps in 1941. But what's also interesting about the prerogative aspect of this is, you mentioned the separation of powers. According to the jurisdictions of the American government, executive orders are supposed to be built on already existing statutes or a constitutionally enumerated presidential power. Well, Trump is blowing that formula up. Let's, for example, take his executive order on birthright citizenship, which is an attempt to end birthright citizenship, as it was described in the 14th Amendment. Now, there's no executive precedent for Trump doing this. There is no existing statute which gives him a precedent to do this. So he's actually abolishing the separation of powers by assuming the ability to make a new law, which is supposed to belong to Congress. And similarly, he's tried to outlaw sanctuary cities, which is the attempt by people to create protective cities that are protective environments for migrants, obviously because he wants to continue to demonize and export and deport immigrants. He's trying to use an executive order as prerogatively to declare sanctuary cities somehow illegal. Well, again, this is a distortion of the separation of powers, because it really is an attempt to make new law out of an executive order without the presence of an existing statute or any previously enumerated presidential power. So in my assessment, the dual state theory works really nicely here, particularly when you're looking at something like the executive order as a form of prerogative power.
Bill, how many executive orders has Trump issued in the last 100 and so days since he's been in office?
I think it's well over 100. Honestly, I've kind of lost count. but it's an astronomical amount. And this is a great example of why I think the dual state theory comes to bear, right? We're actually seeing a president using what Frankl would call prerogative power indiscriminately and repeatedly and almost without check. I mean, we've already seen the Supreme Court, for example, backing some of these executive orders, which themselves seem to be ignoring the separation of powers. So we're in a kind of moment of legal freefall, which Frankl would have understood as basically when the prerogative state has a stronger hand than the normative state. And I think that's kind of the moment that we're in right now.
Trump says it's my prerogative.
Exactly.
The scary thing is the case that the Supreme Court recently decided, called very fittingly Trump versus the United States, where Trump was given carte blanche to do whatever he wants. As long as it's, quote, official action, he can do whatever he wants with no liability. And that's Absolutely. What scared me. Bill, what about talking about restraints on police power?
Well, they're going away, aren't they? I mean, this is a fascinating thing. Frankl talked about the police as one of the tools that certainly the prerogative state used. They certainly did in Nazi Germany. And then we had the proliferation of things like the brown shirts, which were sort of organized, you know, citizen militias, which took on the power of the police. Now, Walter Benjamin, who I think had an influence on Frankl, talked about the police as what he calls law-making powers. And what he meant was the police often function in a society to create new laws, meaning that they participate in activities which under normal circumstances would be considered criminal, like shooting people dead, and they're given a pass for it. And we know that in the United States, the conviction rate for cops that kill people is something like 3%. Well, how does that happen? It happens because police power is really an extension of what Frankl would call the prerogative state. It's one of those domains where lawlessness, or what we call extra legality, is actually created, if that makes sense. So what Frankl's argument is really that when we talk about the rule of law, things like extra legality or lawmaking violence or prerogative law are all ways of muddying the waters of what we think of as a very stable system, i.e. the rule of law. He's arguing that there is constant pressure within the rule of law to exceed itself. And that's really what I think we see all the time, almost every day, with the police. And in fact, if I could just make one point, I know that Trump is trying to undo all these consent decrees, right, which have been placed on police departments like in Minnesota after the George Floyd rebellion, which were attempts to curb, quote unquote, police power. Well, with his prerogative hand, right, Trump is simply trying to undo all that. And in fact, he's doing everything he can to what we would call extend police power further into new areas of violence against the people.
And I would just supplement that with this observation that one of Trump's executive orders calls for giving free legal help to cops, and another is calls for giving more money to policemen. So he's in there doing what he can to support this kind of repression. Bill Mullen, what was the legal status of the Jews in Germany and immigrants here who are called illegal aliens?
Well, the Jews in Germany, I mean, the Nuremberg laws really shifted the legal standing of Jews considerably. They effectively became non-citizens of Germany, meaning that their rights to hold property, their rights to marry, their rights to employment were essentially stripped away as a kind of foundation for the other forms of violence that were enacted against them through things like the death camps, the deportations, the policies that became the Holocaust. And I guess, again, it's really important to understand that the law is often the first thing to go in fascism. I think it was 1933 when Hitler essentially argued for an extension of the power of the state to determine law, and which opened the door for the Nuremberg laws. The other thing I'll say about the Nuremberg laws is, and one of the reasons I'm interested in Frankl, what we call anti-Semitic law or Nuremberg laws in Germany, most of them were inspired by American race laws. German jurisprudence studied Jim Crow really carefully, and a lot of the determinations that were made about the status of Jews followed from the way the United States had restricted the status of African Americans, for example, under Jim Crow. Restrictions on marriage, restrictions on property, restrictions on employment. So when we talk about Frankl as a kind of foundational figure, I think his work on the prerogative state also helps us look backwards to the foundations of what we call race law, right? That's what it was called in the early 20th century in the United States. In our time, the status of undocumented immigrants, I would say it's different from the status of Jews in the 1930s, but there are some similarities. Obviously, they are subject to immediate deportation. They do not have full constitutional protections like so-called citizens. If they're deported from the country, they may not be able to return to the country. They have limited access to benefits. So they have what I would call contingent standing in the United States. And I think to go back to the kind of the big picture, this prerogative state that Trump is building, this prerogative domain of law, is all meant to identify the vulnerability of what he considers to be the internal enemies or dissidents to the state, which means, in effect, non-citizens or those who are not native-born here. So there is, in a lot of ways, overlap, I think, between the status of immigrants and say, Jews in 1930s Germany in terms of the conditionality of their legal standing in the world, which is the basis of their vulnerability.
This is Michael Smith. I'm an attorney here in New York City with Law and Disorder Radio. I'm your host today. I'm speaking with Professor Emeritus Bill Mullen about Ernst Frankl, the German Jewish lawyer and theorist. Bill, dehumanizing certain groups is a slippery slope, isn't it? I mean, alligator Alcatraz is like a concentration camp, really, for brown people. But is it going to go past that?
That's the test of the Trump administration, isn't it? How far can we go? And in my book on the rule of law, I use this phrase, the rule of race. And what I mean by that is how often in history racial law or racialized law is, in fact, the one of the first steps towards authoritarianism or fascism. Obviously, that was true in 1930s Germany. And I talk about a group in the 1940s called the Civil Rights Congress, which brought a petition to the United Nations accusing the United States of genocide using the 1948 definition, the UN definition of genocide, in application to African Americans. This was W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson, and they argued that the history of lynchings and police violence, extra-legal violence against African Americans, was itself a kind of slow genocide against Black people. And they argued that if the law continued to allow, which it was doing, this kind of activity, eventually the United States would end up with its own version of fascism. In fact, they were convinced in about 1950 that for Black people in America, there was a fascistic dimension to life because the law acted in a prerogative way to constantly make them victims of violence. So for sure it's a slippery slope. And the moment that we're in is another example of that slope. And if I could just use one other example, the genocide in Palestine, right, the mass killings of Palestinians has also opened the door for the deportation of Palestinians in the United States, indiscriminate arrests, the criminalization of protest against the war. I mean, gosh, that war has come home, and the policies that are now being used in the United States to target internal enemies are rooted in the violence of that war. So the slope is both domestic and international, and so is the logic.
Yeah, well said, Bill. Bill, how would you apply the dual state concept to the USA today? I'm thinking of ICE, executive orders, the intelligence services, the manipulation of the media, alligator Alcatraz, the destruction of due process of law, the weaponization of anti-Semitism, the crushing of dissent on campuses, and the firing of professors like Maura Finkelstein for expressing criticism of Israel?
Boy, that's a great question, Michael, and I've been thinking about that a lot. You know, I'm almost tempted to say that we are living in a duality state. And what I mean by that is the prerogative use of the law to criminalize, for example, immigrants, Palestinians, migrants, people of color, is now being used as an absolute tool of coercion to bully the spheres of capital. And what I mean by that is businesses have to give up their DEI policies. The media is supposed to be not reporting on things like racial discrimination, right? Universities are being asked to pay the government money, right, so that they will prove that they are willing to crush opposition to Zionism. Now, this is a real weaponization of the prerogative state that I don't think we've seen, and it actually is a mode of accumulation. The state is now extracting or extorting cash money from institutions through the law, through the use of law, right, to build a even more violent state. And I just want to give like two really bracing examples from the last couple of days of how I think this is playing out. The Trump administration has imposed sanctions on a judge in Brazil who is ruling against Bolsonaro. This is extraordinary. In other words, trying to use American law, right, as part of foreign policy to attack a judiciary who is resisting a fascist, which is what Bolsonaro is. Now, I don't know that Frankel could have predicted this, but this is the moment that we're living in. And the second example I'll give of how there's a kind of trickle-down effect of the dual state, where prerogative power, which resides, you know, at the state level, is handed to the hands to its citizens, and that's how we get extra legality. For example, we had the brown shirts, you know, in Germany. At Brown University, which just agreed to pay millions of dollars to the Trump administration, if you look into the fine print of their agreement, they have actually agreed to use student evaluations of professors that are done every semester and to read them at the end of the semester to see if there's any evidence of anti-Semitism on the part of the faculty member, and if so, it would be reported. Well, Brown is making students into brown shirts. They're literally asking them to become informants, right, against anybody who might be opposing this genocidal war. That's really extraordinary, but I would say That's fascist logic. And I think Frankel would say, yes, this is what happens when the prerogative state extends its powers not only horizontally across the state level, but vertically down into the daily lives of its citizens. This is really an extraordinary time. All I can say is we have to be vigilant about fighting every single aspect of this.
Bill, unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time, but I want to conclude with a question for you about the Law and Disorder book that we put out, and you're a contributor to it. And it's a book meant to fight back. Bill, you contributed a chapter to the book that Jim and I worked on. The book is called From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style. It's published by Orr Books. You can get it at orrbooks.com. Bill, please tell us about the book and your chapter.
Yeah, I think this is a tremendous toolkit for people who are trying to understand and fight back against the creeping fascism that we're experiencing in the United States. My chapter, which kind of goes along with everything I've been talking about today, basically my argument is that the law is not going to save us from the prospect of fascism. In fact, the law is one of our problems, and we need to become very fluent in how to fight, not just in the courts, against the kind of legal prerogativeness that we're experiencing that we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes, that we have to think about a way of undoing the law and undoing the courts, and so that we have a society in which justice and fairness and equality are actually determined in other ways. Because the rule of law, as we are experiencing it right now, is actually an enemy to our own liberation. So I'm trying to argue in that chapter for all of us to become basically pro bono anti-fascist fighters against the rule of law itself as it's being practiced under this current administration in Washington.
One last quick question, Bill. How can people follow your work, and what do you think we should be doing in the face of what we've been talking about?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I'm not really too much. I do have a Wikipedia page, which, you know, keeps things updated on what I'm doing and stuff I'm writing. You know, I'm a full-time socialist myself, Michael, and I work with a group of people across the country that's been actually trying to organize at the local level anti-fascist resistance movements. And I also work for the American Association of University Professors as an organizer. You know, last April we had a Day of Action for Higher Education. We had faculty at places like Northwestern holding what they called anti-fascist office hours. They simply went outside and met with their students and talked about fascism and what it was and how we could fight it. I think we need to create lots of spaces in our workplaces and in our campuses and in our unions to have these kind of conversations, not just about fascism as a historical phenomenon, but something that we need to be fighting every day right in front of us.
That's Bill Mullen, M-U-L-L-E-N, Bill Mullen. Bill, what group are we talking about here?
My group's called Socialist Horizon, and we have comrades across the country, and we publish a magazine called Punto Rojo, in Spanish, P-U-N-T-O-R-O-J-O. In fact, we just put up an editorial today about the need to feed the people of Gaza and end the occupation there. So if people go to puntorojo.com, that'll take you to Socialist Horizon's writings and work.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder Radio. We hope to have you back quickly. You take it easy.
You too, Michael. Take care.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
There are so many horrendous consequences from Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, the tens of thousands of lost lives, with who knows how many thousands still buried under the rubble of war. The intentional starvation of the Palestinian people, the vast destruction of their schools and hospitals and homes and places of business. And then there is the targeting of journalists in Gaza, trying to report the news of the war. To date, more of them have already been killed by the Israeli military than were killed in the Civil War, First and Second World Wars, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the War on Afghanistan combined. So today we cover the story of Israel's attempt to keep complete and accurate news coverage of the war from the rest of the world, and the costly results of its attempts to do so, the hundreds of lost lives of those brave journalists who are determined to report news of the war, no matter what the personal risks and costs may be. Fortunately, due to the commitment of our guest today, there is now a documentary film that tells the story of what is at stake for the journalists covering the news of the war in Gaza. It is called Gaza, Journalists Under Fire. The director and producer of this vitally important film is Robert Greenwald. Mr. Greenwald is the founder of Brave New Films, a nonprofit social justice media organization, and the director of numerous long and short-form documentaries, including Uncovered, The War on Iraq, Unmanned, America's Drone Wars, Rethink Afghanistan, and many more. Well, Robert Greenwald, a very warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you all.
I'm wondering, Robert, what motivated you in the first place to do a film about the war in Gaza, the war against the Palestinian people, and do it from the point of view of the dangers of the journalists covering that horrific war?
There were a couple of factors that led to my doing it and doing it particularly this way. The first was, as the stories about the war grew on social media, not unfortunately in corporate media, I became more and more convinced that it was important to do something. I was warned by friends and colleagues and funders not to do it, but having done over the years various films that focused on the ills and the pains and the horrors that war can bring, I felt I would be a hypocrite and a coward if I did not take this on. So I made a decision, and this is one of the wonders and beauties of having an ongoing nonprofit. I made the decision we were going to do something. Then it became a question of what could, should we do that might have an impact that wasn't being done. So the goal was to reach millions of people who perhaps were not engaged with this issue. And to be very clear, I was not after or interested or trying to reach the haters, those who are in some way locked in, who believe that the only good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian, or that Israel can never do anything wrong. I was not interested and not going to spend time or energy. However, the millions of other people, I felt we could potentially reach them with a story of journalists being killed, because even those who perhaps were not emotionally or intellectually aboard on this, I felt strongly would not be willing, able, or accepting of killing of journalists. So that was the first part of it. Then, as we did the research, it became clearer and clearer that there was an opportunity to do what one of the things I think that we do best at Brave New Films, which is put a human face on policy. Other people do books that are important, white papers, studies, but we can, and this is the wonder and strength of video film, we could put a face on it. So we spent quite a bit of time, the great team at Brave New Films, and we researched. There were, by that point, I think it was about 180 journalists who've been killed. It's now over 220, 230. And we slowly but painfully brought the number down where we chose those who had a strong presence. And most importantly, for the purposes of film, had lots of social media material. So we went through their social media hours and hours of looking at clips on different platforms. And at one point, I remember so clearly, there was a clip of a 5-year-old girl. She was having a birthday party. And as a father, as a grandfather, and as somebody with many children in my life in many different ways, it immediately grabbed me, as it did my colleagues. And I knew at that moment that we were on to an approach that could be emotionally effective if we could find the clips and if we could build the stories so that, in a sense, we were bringing these journalists to life even after they'd been killed. And that became the goal, that became what we were focused on, and that became the effort to do that, which would be a contribution to humanizing some of these journalists, to making some of the Palestinians not just a statistic, and the goal being to activate, motivate people to take action, because ultimately there's been zero accountability. And if there was more, if some of these journalists had lived, if international journalists had been allowed in, there would have been more accountability, and it would have happened well before the horrors that we're seeing every day now of people literally starving to death.
Robert, talk to us about the nuts and bolts of making the film Gaza Journalists Under Fire. Where did you obtain such dramatic footage? You spoke a little bit about sifting through social media. And also tell us how you protected yourself emotionally from immersing yourself into the stories of victims and survivors.
Well, the emotional question is a good one. And if I can use perhaps a little bit of humor here, probably 200 years of therapy helped me be able to deal with that. But it was an ongoing challenge. But again, to be clear, seeing what the Palestinians in Gaza were going through put a perspective on anything that myself, my colleagues might be experiencing, because it wasn't even in the same universe as the horrors that they were being subjected to. Knowing that we're fortunate enough to be able to offer these films and this film free, always free, we're having screenings literally all around the world right now, including in Gaza, including in Palestine, including in Israel, including in South Africa, and then many in the United States. Knowing that was the ultimate goal, we wanted to make the film accessible without minimizing, accessible without downgrading, and accessible without dumbing up or down. And so the work of the research of digging in and finding the clips was literally a several-month process. And then some of the extraordinary people in Gaza, relatives and friends of some of the journalists in the film, we would reach out to them out of respect and wanting them to know we were doing this. And one of Heba's sister, Sabine, came forward. She videoed herself. There's a clip in the film now, and it really shakes my soul every time I talk about it. And she mentions it, Sabine. She had 56 of her relatives killed. Uncles, aunts, grandfathers, grandchildren, you name it. And there was relatives of hers that had been killed. And yet, she is committed and was appreciative that the film was being made and wanted to keep her sister's presence alive through the film. Now, I don't know what's happened. We were in constant touch with her till about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and then things got worse and worse in Gaza, which I didn't think was possible. And at that point, she said, I don't have internet access. I don't have electricity. I can't contact you, and I have to move for safety reasons. So we haven't heard anything since then, and hopefully she is safe someplace. But it was people like Sabine and several colleagues of some of the journalists who've been killed who found ways to video themselves and then to get the material to us. So we were able to include it in the film, so that you have most of the film is the human personal clips, the social media stories, and some of it quite upsetting because of who was killed. And then you have some of the friends, colleagues, and relatives of those men killed. And then we have some of the experts from Amnesty International and Committee to Protect Journalists and Reporters Without Borders, all of whom have been increasingly clear, accurate, and fact-based about what was and is going on tragically day after day, week after week, and month after month. And it's still continuing.
Yeah, I don't want to miss one point you just made a moment ago. The film is free. That's not normally the case in our country about anything, let alone important films like this. And it's free because you want people to use this film for organizing purposes, for educational purposes of your own. I've seen the film. It's an extraordinary film. It's a wonderful film. Wonderful, perhaps, is a wrong word to use, because it's a very upsetting film, of course, as well, and the subject matter is truly upsetting. And it's about 40 minutes long, so it's not an unduly lengthy film. How do people go about getting this film and using it? Let's talk about that before we lose that thought.
Thank you. It's really the most important thing we can talk about. So it's free, and if you go to bravenewfilms.org, you can sign up for a screening. Now, a screening can be you and a significant other in your room watching it. It can be 30 people in a faith community. It can be 300 people in a classroom or a meeting or a fundraiser. Organizations all over the world have been using the film now to fundraise, which is a wonderful, satisfying experience. So we make it very, very easy to get the film. It'll come with a guide as to how to do a screening if you've had any questions about it. But it's really as simple as possible, so that there's never a barrier in terms of cost or technology. And we've also have clips on all the social media platforms. So if you have a friend or relative or colleague who perhaps is not ready to watch 40 minutes, you can go to literally every single one of the platforms, follow me or Brave New Films, and there'll be clips there that you can send to people and you can send to elected officials as a way to try to get them to follow Bernie Sanders' wonderful lead about legislation that can make a difference. You can send it to local radio and TV stations who have almost completely ignored us, except for wonderful folks like you all, so that you can do something. You know, there's that expression, learned helplessness. I don't think it's learned. I think it's perhaps taught us or pushed down our throat. We can't be helpless here. This is a tragedy. Lives are at stake every day, and every single person listening to the show and others can do and must do something. That's why it's free. That's why we make it accessible in any and all possible ways.
I would encourage our audience to take advantage of that and take advantage of that very kind and important offer that you've just made. Let's talk a little bit more, though. It was passed over rather quickly. Let's talk a little bit more about why you selected these particular. You focused on journalism and what's happening to the journalists in general, but you picked three in particular to focus on. Why was that?
Well, the number was limited because I didn't want to make a 10-hour film that nobody would watch and would not motivate people. These particular three was a process of choosing, researching, and unfortunately, there were many, many, many more we could have done. The final decision-making came down to wanting to have some variety in terms of the job, the kind of journalism that each one of the three did. We wanted to make sure that we had some gender diversity. And then with those parameters, was there enough social media on each one of our final candidates to bring them to life? And that took quite a bit of time, and as I was saying, quite a bit of research. And the ultimate decision making was, oh yes, this person or his relative or his wife or his sister or her sister, there's lots and lots there. So for each of the stories that run, oh, somewhere between 9 and 14 minutes, there was probably 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours worth of material that myself and Casey and Sean and Katiana and Tiana all went through choosing and selecting and shaping.
Robert Greenwald, are journalists in Gaza easily and clearly identified as members of the press by how they're dressed or otherwise? And of course, does their identity as members of the press serve to protect them or make them targets?
I assumed when I began this that their identity protected them. But there's a clip in the movie, which it was a shock, and it almost took my breath away, where journalists, Palestinian journalists, are taking off their clearly marked large press vests, and they're throwing them on a pile because they are convinced that the press vests are serving as a target to be killed. Similarly, there are press vehicles. Show one of them that's right after it's been attacked and destroyed. Same idea from many of our journalists and now other experts who've talked about the targeting of journalists, the fact that Israel in other situations can find someone sitting in his living room and bomb attack, kill him with great precision, and yet hundreds of journalists, over 17,000 children, thousands of medical workers, many clearly innocent women and senior citizens. That can't be an accident at the level and the scale at which it is happening. Destruction of almost all the schools, destruction of almost all the hospitals. So it's not just the journalists. It's part of this systemic, horrific pattern that will hopefully stop, and hopefully those who've been responsible will at some point in some way be brought to the criminal system.
Well, and in terms of bringing people to accountability, with respect to the reporters, the journalists themselves who have been killed, the targeting, the deliberate targeting, of course, of journalists under international law is a crime. It's a war crime. Have any charges, in fact, been brought against Israel alleging such war crimes against the journalists that have been killed, the number of which, as you say, is about 230 at this point?
There has been a case brought before the ICC in which is seeming to be making some progress, where Bibi and others in his administration have been accused, brought up on charges, not allowed in certain countries, but particularly, specifically around the killing of journalists, I'm not aware of a case that focuses on that. I believe there will be. I hope that the film and your audience watching and raising hell can be part of making that happen. But so far, the lack of accountability has been, I don't want to say shocking because it seems systemic, but the lack of accountability is not an accident at this point.
Well, Robert, in terms of journalists killed so far in Gaza, do we know how many were killed by Israeli armed forces, or were some killed by Hamas or other forces?
The Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, has a very, very good website, which we used as a significant resource. And virtually all of the journalists that they found in the sense that were killed, and there is proof and evidence of that, were all killed by the Israeli military in some shape or form. It doesn't mean that there weren't some who may have been killed by Hamas, but to my knowledge, no one has come up with that evidence. What we try to do with this film and all of the films over the years is make sure we stick to the facts. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have a point of view. It doesn't mean we try to say everybody is equal, because it's not. The killing is not equal in any shape or form. It's never fun, but I don't object to being attacked for a point of view. I don't want to be attacked or in any way hurt the messaging by being inaccurate on our facts. So we're perhaps overly careful about that. But in all the years of doing this, we have never been attacked on a factual basis.
I'm wondering, too, as we're talking about the source of the deaths of these so many journalists, it's an alarming, extraordinary number. Were some of them perhaps just collateral damage? I don't mean dismissively. Life is still lost. Life is still a lost life. But given what is going on in Gaza, it's hard to avoid and the extensiveness of the Israeli attack. So do we know for a fact that some of these may have been lost in collateral damage as opposed to that targeted killing that is also taking place?
Well, we don't know, and I don't think we'll ever know with 100% certainty, but not in any way to justify. But bear in mind that the so-called collateral damage is, for the most part, innocent people who are not in the military, who are not shot holding a weapon. They are journalists, healthcare workers, children, women, and aged people. And that's possible that in that large number of people, is that collateral damage? Is that targeted? Is it malpractice? How do you characterize it? I don't have the words for it, but it's clear that this is going on at an unprecedented level, and it's clear that it's an effort to eliminate, exterminate the Palestinians, and it's clear that it's a war crime and many war crimes, and this will be going on for many years, and it's one of the reasons I'm so glad, if I can use that word in this context, that we were able to make the film, since I know I and many other people don't want to look back at this time and say, oh, well, we were upset, but we didn't do anything. And I'm hoping that every one of your listeners and the people that you speak to will decide to take action. And that's what the film is for. That's why it's out there. It's to be a tool that helps you activate, motivate, energize, and do something rather than say, oh, it's terrible and it's sad, but I can't do anything.
Robert Greenwald has already mentioned that this film is available to any of our listeners who want it free of charge. The idea being that you would take this 40-some minute film and you would show it in your church, your union hall, to your friends. You would use it as a way to educate people about what is being done in our name in Gaza today. You could do that by simply going to Brave New Films, which is the name of the company of Robert Greenwald, and thereby learn how to do what I've just said. And so thank you for that again.
Robert, you mentioned earlier that making this movie was challenging for you personally, and also that you don't mind being criticized for your viewpoint. Have you been accused of being anti-Semitic? And if so, how do you respond?
Yes, I've been accused. It's an idiotic and moronic attack of the lowest possible kind. It makes no sense whatsoever. And we are now just finishing a very short 2-3 minute piece, which is, who's the anti-Semite? And what we do is we clip together people high up in the Israeli government, in the military, and Mossad, all of whom in this video are highly critical of the war. I'm hoping that it'll be helpful in stopping this notion that anybody who's critical of a policy of a state, anybody who's critical, who objectively is one of the worst officials heading any government, any place, anybody who speaks out like that is anti-Semitic. I would actually argue it's the opposite. If you don't speak out, that you are in some ways turning over your papers as a human being.
All right, Robert Greenwald, sadly, we are just about out of time. Remind our listeners again how they can get a copy of this important film, Gaza Journalists Under Fire, and get it for free, and what you hope they do with it. And any other last thoughts you'd like to leave us with, sir?
BraveNewFilms.org. The website is there, and it's an easiest possible way. You give them, you give the website your information, and they'll send you a link. Immediately, a screening can be 3 people or it can be 30,000 people. We've had everything along the spectrum. And we count on every one of you to do something. Don't look away. Don't turn away. It's painful and it's unpleasant. But action is key. The polls, if you believe them, have radically shifted on this issue. And that means people like our hosts for today and your listeners are making a difference, and we will make a difference on this. So thank you for having us and spreading the word, and on to victory.
Well, and we thank you so much for your work, not just on this film, but you had a very successful commercial career, and to do what you've done now with this part of your life is just quite amazing. All of your films are quite amazing, as is Gaza, Journalist Under Fire. Listeners, I do urge you to take up Robert's suggestion of using this film to help educate yourselves and others in your community. Robert Greenwald, thank you for joining us today on Law and Disorder, my friend.
My pleasure. Thank you all.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at an investigative report by the Electronic Frontier Foundation criticizing the use of artificial intelligence tools to automate the writing of police reports.
Beryl Lipton, a senior investigative researcher, explains the concerns with AI-generated police reports, such as improper reviews and it being used as shields for law enforcement accountability.
We then talk with the producer of a new documentary titled The Last Class. It follows the work of political economist Robert Reich.
Our guest is the film's producer, Heather Kinlaw Lofthouse, who will explain how the documentary takes a profound look at the widening inequalities of income and wealth in the last half century in America.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
Police departments across the United States are beginning to use artificial intelligence tools, like Axon's Draft 1, to automate the writing of police reports based on body-worn camera audio. While the goal is to save time and reduce paperwork, digital rights advocates are raising serious concerns. The Electronic Frontier Foundation warns that Draft 1 lacks transparency, making it hard to tell whether errors or biases in reports come from the AI or from the officer. They argue this could compromise accountability and justice. The ACLU has also flagged risks tied to AI's potential for inaccuracy and bias.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show